Welcome to S3, the science, sex and sorcery podcast, where each month we'll be bringing you news, reviews, recommendations and deeper discussion from the worlds of science fiction, romance and fantasy. I'm Belinda Misson, a romance writer published by HarperCollins UK.
And I'm Terence McManus, and I'm an indie SFF writer.
This podcast exists because Terence and I realised that if we were going to waste the hours we should have been writing by talking about everything we've read lately, we may as well put that discussion to good use. And coming from various writing backgrounds, from podcasting, self-publishing and traditional, allows us to bring unique perspectives and experience to each book that we choose.
We'll be releasing new podcasts once a month, reviewing a book for you each time and giving you our insights to the stories and news items from across the publishing world. Now, despite the COVID-19 outbreak cancelling bookish events across the globe these last couple of weeks, we can still look for a bit of positive news in all of this. After all, if we're all self-isolating at home, we want to do that with books, don't we? If you're looking for a good place to start with some top-notch Australian science fiction and fantasy content, the Aurealis Awards have just announced their shortlist for the 2019 awards season. We'll put a link to the list in the show notes, but there are some great Aussie authors and some phenomenal fiction represented there, so it's a fantastic resource if you're looking for something fresh, new, and excellent to read. And in the spirit of sci-fi, I was also beside myself this month when Disney announced their new publishing initiative set in the High Republic era of the Star Wars universe, which is about 200 years before Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
And I haven't heard about this one yet, so you're going to have to fill me in.
It sounds really promising for the Star Wars fans out there. This is going to be looking at the Galactic Republic when it was at the height of its glory. And it is, at least so far, going to be solely explored through books, comics, and graphic novels. The project has some very familiar names in current Star Wars literature too, with Charles Soule, author of a slew of Star Wars comics, leading the charge with Light of the Jedi, releasing in August this year. And I don't know about you, Belinda, but I spent a lot of my late teens and early 20s completely absorbed by the Star Wars expanded universe across the novels and the comic books. So I'm really keen to see this new era and get the deep dive it deserves into this part of Star Wars history. It's definitely going to be something to look forward to while we're all staying inside chugging litres of hand sanitizer.
Well, I think I spent my late teens and early 20s reading Mills and Boone, and we're just about out of hand sanitizer here, so thank God for soap. We've still got plenty of that here. But as for social distancing, staying inside and reading books, I know I'm well prepared in that area. This month saw the release of The Mirror and the Light, which is the final installment of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall trilogy. For those not familiar with the trilogy, it follows the life and times of Thomas Cromwell around the time of Henry VIII. It's been an absolute juggernaut for publishing. In its first week of sales alone, The Mirror and the Light sold in excess of 95,000 copies, which is something most of us can only dream of. And in signing news, one of my absolute favourite authors, Vari McFarlane, has signed a new two-book deal with HarperCollins. She's one of my auto-buy authors, so I'm already hitting the pre-order button.
That's fantastic. And speaking of reading and the end of the world, following our rom-com selection last month, we thought we'd pick up a lovely dystopian science fiction number to talk about today, which was rather prescient perhaps, given that we picked this read well before the word COVID-19 had even hit the news cycle. And so, in that vein, we've gone with Andrew Hunter Murray's debut novel, The Last Day.
I'm sure we picked this before the end of last year even.
Yeah, it's been on our books for a while, hasn't it?
And some of you may be familiar with Andrew Hunter Murray as one of the writers for QI, which I think is on BBC. And as someone who loves QI, I was keen to get my hands on this one.
Yeah, me too. I've also been listening to Andrew himself for years on the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast, where he and three of his fellow QI writers get together to talk about the funniest facts they've come across in their research that week. So I was real keen to get a taste of his fiction writing in addition to that. But for now, let's let the book talk for itself. Here's what the cover blurb of the novel has to say. A world half in darkness, a secret she must bring to light. 2059. The world has stopped turning. One half suffers an endless frozen night. The other nothing but burning sun. Only in a slim twilit region can life survive. In an isolationist Britain, Ellen Hopper receives a letter from a dying man. It contains a powerful and dangerous secret, one that those in power will kill to conceal.
That blurb alone, to me, is certain to draw a crowd. If we look at the time that it's set in, 2059, it's close enough that we can imagine the world that it's set in. And I know that we picked it because, Terry, you were already reviewing this for Aurelius magazine. So how did you go with the book? How did you find it?
Well, my first thought when I read this book was, boy, it is nice to read a sci-fi novel written by a professional science communicator. Someone who's spent, what, over a decade now bringing facts and interesting scientific tidbits to the public.
Amazing!
Yeah, the science in this book is amazing. It is some top-shelf vintage. I was constantly taken back by just the simple and the really kind of obvious effects that Murray was describing for each of the changes that he made to this world. The things I'd never thought to think about, like how the ocean currents might be affected if the Earth stopped spinning, and what the flow-on effect that would have down the entire food chain would be. Things like how eliminating most of humanity might sound like it would halt climate change in its tracks, except for the fact that most of the oxygen-creating plant life we have can't exist in either the absolute cold of the night side or the absolute heat of the day side. So really all that does is just change the specific problem we're facing. And even supposed facts like, well, if the Earth stops spinning, the centrifugal force will stop creating gravity for us, are very patiently and gently explained to dullards like me who'd internalize that message somewhere along the line and never thought to stop and actually question it.
I don't think anyone questioned it.
No, it's one of those things you always sort of, I don't know, we heard it somewhere, didn't we? And we're like, oh, that sounds about right.
We're all just going to float away and pop.
And I honestly feel that now I've walked away from this book with a better understanding of orbital mechanics, ocean currents, climate change, a whole bunch of other sides as well. And that's on top of feeling like I've just read a really enjoyable story.
I think that was one of my favourite parts of the book. I couldn't quite get enough of the, so you think this is going to happen? Well, you're wrong type of stuff at the beginning. Like you mentioned, as kids, we were all told that if the Earth stopped spinning, we would fall off, probably pop, float off into space and die. So that's what I've been running on for years. But then here comes Andrew Hunter Murray telling us, well, that actually wouldn't happen, and here's why. And again, the other bits he'd brought up in regards to tides and how that all affects the rise and fall of currents and how they would change, how they would heat, how they would cool, along with the planet temperatures and the climate change, as you said, growing plants in either terminable frost or absolute heat can't be done. And I gobbled up that stuff. It was fascinating. And it's the kind of smart science fiction that I love to read, much like The Martian by Andy Weir. There's enough grounding in the real world to make it believable. But the science that is there is explained in such a way that regular readers can still feel like part of the story, like they've learnt. And in this case, scarily so.
Yeah, you're right about the scary too, especially in the social sciences aspect of the novel, where I felt a lot of the messaging that he had in this was eerily close to reality. I mean, we had here a Great Britain literally bombing refugee boats to keep foreigners off their shores, and that seemed a little too close to a feasible idea.
Doesn't it just? It's something that's not too difficult to imagine. And I think it was a really interesting choice for us to read this at the moment. When you look at the UK having left the EU, or any country really at the moment that's shutting its borders and doing its utmost to keep people out. I mean, in Australia, we've got a travel ban. We cannot leave the country without a very good reason at the moment. And that's obviously because of medical issues and overloading an already strained system. But it plays in to the current global pandemic, especially if we get to a point where, you know, other countries may have an overloaded system and people will look for a way out. And even that seems a little strange to be saying that out loud, but it could happen. And aside from keeping travellers or refugees out, as this book was doing, I found that there was a lot of political discussion without it being too preachy one way or another. It was just, here are the options and here's what's happening and here's the fallout from both of these sides. And that went through to talk about climate change and civil control, political control, as in the right of the government to exert absolute control over citizens, where you go, where you're watched, times of days you're allowed to leave your house, which is what we're currently experiencing in real time. But in this case, it was ratcheted up to 10 in the event of a natural disaster.
Yeah, you're right. As far as set pieces go, this really hits the sweet spots for right now in 2020.
I wonder if he imagined that when he wrote it, or he just thought, no, this is just way too off.
Oh, I can't. Can you imagine what he's feeling right now when he's looking at the world and his
book, reading his book going, oh, I've just predicted
this. The book only came out in February. This is still really new. It's like, what on earth
is going on?
You know, you'd be going, if I was him, run out and buy a Tazzalotto ticket. I mean, crikey.
Yeah.
Right now, 2020, looking at the same kind of social control under these very different parameters, it is really interesting. Really interesting to see. And at the broad stroke level like that, I found I was really engaged with this version of the world that Murray was building. I thought the internal consistency that it had was pretty good, although it got a little strained in some specific points at some key moments, which I'm sure we'll get to. Everything else seemed well thought out and really logically following on from itself, like the science. I found it particularly interesting, too, how each time one of those factual scientific tidbits was delivered, it almost directly coincided with me reading something that made me think, well, wait, hang on. Wouldn't that mean XYZ? And I think the narrative being built to answer my questions like that, the very moment that I thought to ask them, that to me says really great writing.
It really was. I thought it was brilliant writing. The world building was incredible. Far too close to home at the moment, but it was really well done. You could picture everything that was being shown in a scarily realistic way. And I know that I say that a lot, but we do live in a scary world at the moment where a lot of these things are happening. Characters in this book couldn't leave their house at night. They couldn't walk around and do these things. And there was a lot of civil control. There was police and army out to make sure that people did the right thing. And I could see how easily now that can become a reality. I could also picture the different boroughs of London, places that I've walked through, talking about Brixton and the tube lines being full of water, the blockades and the checkpoints at off-ramps. I could picture all of that very vividly. And the way, as you said, the facts were dropped in among the writing. I also adored the use of language, and not just in the world-building sense, but in the way in which things were described and the adjectives that were reflective of the mood of the writing that was all very, very dark and dank and wet and damp. And I'd add an example here, except I don't have my copy of the book on hand. I've given it to my dad to read. But the way that sentences were framed to help the mood helped to pack an extra punch.
Yeah, the writing was very good. So it sounds like we can agree that we thought that the world is broadly just fantastic. What did you think about the specifics of the story that was set inside that world, though? Ellen's journey from her isolation on the oil rig in chapter one, going into...
Which would be a really good place to be right now, an oil rig in the middle of the ocean, just going to say.
People are clamoring to get out there. Safety. Oh, do you reckon they have toilet paper out there? That's a big question.
They've probably got heaps of toilet paper. They've probably got recycled paper, copies of the Daily Mail.
Well, it must have been a shock for Ellen and for the reader, perhaps, going from that isolation on the oil rig into police state Britain as she's hunting down this secret that we find could topple this entire Orwellian-style dictatorship that's been built up. How did that story grip you?
So this is where it gets interesting, isn't it? I know that we talked a lot about this sort of online, and while I loved the world building and the use of language, I thought the story itself fell a bit flat in that it was probably dragged out about 100 pages too long. As you say, Ellen is working on an oil rig and she's summoned over to Britain to meet her old university professor. As it turns out, he's dying and he's got some important wisdom he needs to impart on her before he shuffles off this mortal coil, not COVID-19 related. So the powers that be think that this information is just mind-bogglingly important, and they need to know what it is too, which causes all kinds of drama for Alan in a cat-and-mouse game that the book eventually becomes. For the most part, though, I felt like it was a little bit the cat gets the mouse, bats it around for a little bit, doesn't do too much damage, and lets it go scurrying off into the corner again, which then sets us up for going around in a cycle. So the thing that I found was that while Alan has hurdles, they don't really stop her. There's not that conflict of creating giant roadblocks, which is something I would expect in a book that's marketed as a thriller. Now, did you find that or was it just me?
I'm going to quickly break in here to say, you know, your metaphor is excellent because that literal exact thing happened here last week. Our frigging cat got a mouse, spent so much damn time playing with the stupid thing.
Playing with it.
That it got away. And we haven't seen it since. I'm like, God damn it, cat, you've got one job.
One job.
This is what happens to your entire, this happens to your entire dictatorship if you let that damn thing get away.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we'll get back to it. Sorry. No, I absolutely found that as well. And I think you've hit the nail right on the head. For me, this worked as an excellent sci-fi novel, but a pretty mid-list thriller.
And agreed.
I think part of that is due to how the narrative intersected with the world building, which was excellent. But I think part of it relates to a little theory that I have regarding the novel, which I'll bring up a bit later. And without spoiling too much of the plot, I think there was a fundamental disconnect between what was happening to Ellen and how the government was being set up as this omnipresent oppressive force. Because it seems like Ellen has got a bit of a charmed life in this story. She's blithely sauntering through situations which are getting the secondary or the tertiary characters just disappeared by the state or outright shot. And although there's some justification ultimately given as to why this is, it didn't really land with me by the time we got there. This is the only time where the book didn't address my concerns quickly enough. Because by the time that justification comes, we've already ho-hummed our way through several narrative arcs where the perceived danger to Ellen just goes nowhere or was built up just for nothing to happen. And I'd already internalized that as just the way that the story was being told by the time.
Well, she gets beaten up and you think she's going to have broken bones and cuts and concussion, and she just kind of gets up and goes on again.
Yeah, exactly. And all of the other situations where she seems to come right up to the line of, or she seems to cross the line of what we know is acceptable in this state, and then just sort of skips back over the line again as soon as anybody's watching. And I think you've either got to have this crushing dictatorship that curtails all personal freedoms and murders anyone in the way, or you don't. I mean, I felt they, the government, the characters were incredibly lenient with how they dealt with Ellen. And the only real justification we get for that for most of the book is because she's the protagonist, right?
Exactly. And without her, there's no book. And let me touch on one of the first points you made. It's definitely a brilliant science fiction book. I think we can just put it up on the shelf there and it will be fine. It's something I could and I have handed to my dad and that he would probably enjoy for the science aspect of it. As for a thriller, it does fall a little flat. And I think you're right about the government as a character. If it is the draconian existence and we're being told about people being shot on sight for being out after curfew, which we were told plenty of times, we did end up with a scene where the police just dropped Ellen off wherever she needed to go. She said she had to go to Hampstead to see her husband. And they were like, yeah, no worries. Get in the front. We'll drop you off. No problem. While they've got a whole truck full of people ready to take off to jail for doing exactly the same thing. So in that aspect, I found it increasingly unbelievable that she was able to traipse through London and solve all these mini riddles while the rest of the world was just happening around her. And as you said, secondary characters died because of her and there was little to no explanation or fallout from it. There was one character in particular that I expected her to be upset about. She should have been hugely upset about it, regardless of the fractured relationship that existed between them. And she simply drove off into the night with not much more than, well, we need to go and do this thing now. So while I was thrilled to find that the book had a female protagonist, especially in such a STEM-based role and book, I found her emotions didn't quite add up from the perspective of a female. And I don't know if that's just a me thing or if it's a matter of a male versus female. I don't think it's a male versus female thing at this point. It's just a matter of making her a decent human being with emotions. And like you, I spent chunks of the book kind of meandering through the narrative. Like, there's no justification for some of this. She's just kind of wandering. She gets out of this situation really easily. At one point, she's run out of a warehouse and down the street. A Samaritan lets her into the backyard. The police knock and take it on their word that she's not there. I mean, if it's a totalitarian regime, I would have thought it'd be something more along the lines of, she can't have got that far, open up and let us look for her. So that to me was a little bit too convenient. And when we get to the end and find out that I'm going to give away the ending. But when we find out that the government kind of already knows what she's looking for, it kind of negated the entire thing, which was really disappointing.
Yeah, it sounds like we both had the same sort of reaction there. And I don't think it's giving away too much of the ending to say that, honestly, because it's not impactful to the story.
Yeah, true.
Really.
Yeah, so
it's and
I think I haven't told anyone what she was looking for.
No, and well, we'd never know what she's looking for, sort of until the end. And it's not. I think that the fact that it's not impactful is part of the problem that we had with it. By the time the story climaxed with that reveal and whether she gets what she was looking for or not, all I found myself wondering in that moment is why Ellen, this loner with no real family attachments and a highly specialized job in a field that the government actively doesn't care about, why she wasn't just dropped out of the helicopter that picked her up at the end of chapter one and that was that.
Just pushed into the sea, right?
Exactly.
Off you go. You're the last connection. We don't care. In the water. Even if she only knew a minuscule amount of Thorne's secret, Thorne is the character who sent the letter, she was apparently the last one to know. So you're right. Drop her into the ocean and no one needs to worry about Thorne or his secret and they can all move on with their lives, end of story. But maybe that's just my inner editor coming out, but there are certainly aspects of the story that I would have changed to maybe make that a bit more believable.
Yeah. Look, I'm curious, what did you think about the general pacing of this as a thriller novel? Because I've got my little theory, which relates to why it's paced the way it is, but right before we get there, I'm interested to hear your opinion on it first, specifically to the pacing.
So for a thriller, I expected that this would move along a lot quicker. Things would snap, there'd be action, there'd be quick dialogue, there'd be running, there'd be heartbeats, there'd be sweat. But this was more of a slow meandering through someone's life and history as they got on with the story around them. The book was set over the course of about 3 days, which I think is fair because I don't think Hopper could have done much better under the circumstances, but I did find the pace to be quite slow. There was a lot of travelling, which is fine because it helps with world building. We get to look out of car windows and as she walks down streets, we get to see, you know, the tube, we get to see the little enclaves of people, but it's just still a lot of waiting for things to happen, waiting for her to get somewhere. And I kind of expect that a thriller would happen at breakneck speed. We'd be holding our breath and waiting for the next big moment to arrive. And then we're interrupted by a flashback to Thorne. And I found myself getting frustrated with these towards the end of the story because things would begin to ramp up and the action would happen and you're getting really excited because, oh my God, something's going to happen. And we turn the page and we're back in his office in Oxford 10 years ago trying to piece together his side of the story. And I think that those scenes, while they were short, still provided so little information that they could have been woven through the main arc of the book a bit better, through side quests or, God, anything, memories, something that would make the pace a bit quicker. How did you find the flashbacks, or was that just me?
Yeah, I think I expected more from those flashback scenes as well. And when the big reveal came about, you know, what happened the last time they spoke, my response to that was kind of, oh, is that all?
The big reveal, right? And I'm right there with you on that. I had hoped for something with a bit more spectacle. I'm not sure what exactly, but I was definitely looking for more.
Well, as far as spectacle, perhaps, and the general pacing of the novel is concerned, that ties kind of back into where I think my little theory comes in. So the whole way through this novel, I kept thinking, even from the very start of it, that the writing style and the presentation of the story really reminded me of a BBC miniseries. That gradual meandering narrative that you so accurately describe has three or four real anchor points, like that moment when Hopper is questioned and beaten half to death, the reveal about some of the people who are close to her, the museum, the scene when she's fleeing that warehouse, and then, of course, the climax of the entire narrative right at the end. Each time the narrative, it sort of swells to these climactic moments before it then kind of fizzles away back into the story.
It fades to black and says, to be continued.
Yeah, it's kind of like that dramatic conclusion to the end of an episode before the series continues on. And I note that the television rights to this story have already been sold. So given Murray's background as an episodic writer for TV and podcasting, it wouldn't shock me if this novel was written with an eye on the silver screen from the very get-go, and that's resulted in some of those issues that we both picked up on that with engaging us across the novel, and that apparent lack of payoff for those moments that Hopper finds herself in. Because when we're reading it as a book, we don't have the benefit of a week's wait to play on that tension before the next part of the story moves on. I mean, we just flip the page and there it is.
See, and that's a great point about television. You've that week break that you get between episodes gives you time to ramp up and the anticipation and the, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And it will probably work very well as a television series. And the more that I think about how it's written, it really did read quite episodic. And I feel that I need to reiterate that I really did enjoy the story, despite the issues that we both seem to have with it. I love the language. It was completely atmospheric. I don't think it's an author problem. I just think at some point an editor could have picked up the ball a little bit better. But I am really keen to see how this one goes as a teleseries because, of course, things may be reordered or dropped altogether. So I actually think it might make a great punchy 4 or 6-part series.
Yeah, I absolutely think so too. And I'm with you as well. For all the little gripes that we've had there in the thriller aspect of the novel, it was still a great story. It was well told and it's set in one of the better sci-fi dystopias that I've read in recent years, and there has been a lot of them lately. We're living in one.
We are. We really are.
So it'll be good to see how that translates, if and when it does make it to TV.
Well, but probably not for a while now.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, that has impacted everything, hasn't it? With casting and people being together to produce content. Gosh. Well, until filming and release schedules are sorted out, though, our world continues to turn, and with it comes an opportunity for the next read. Now, I'm currently working my way through the third book in V.S. Holmes' Blood of the Titans Reforged series. I've already read the first two books of that, and I really enjoyed them, so I'm still in the early pages of this one, but looking forward to good things. How about you, Belinda? What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've been a bit busy with the books at the moment. So in the last week, I've read Adam Kay's 'Twas the Night Shift Before Christmas. So Adam is now a TV comedy writer, but he began his professional career as a doctor. So it's a collection of stories from the front line of the NHS, which is very topical at the moment. His writing is just hilarious. It's a follow-up to his first book called This Is Going to Hurt. We follow him through 7 Christmases, I think, working in a hospital, and all the weird and wonderful things that he comes across on Christmas Eve. It's just, it's insane, and it's a laugh and it's touching in equal measure. I then went and gobbled up Paris Letters by Janice McLeod, which is her story of how she packed in corporate life in America. She was a copywriter for a rather large company and she decided she'd had enough. She went to live in Paris for 2 years, which I think at some point a lot of writers have dreamt of doing. I know I would be quite happy if someone said, here's some money, go live in Shakespeare and Co. for a couple of years.
Oui, oui.
Wee wee. And now I've moved on to reading a book called All About Us by Tom Ellen, which looks like it's a bit of a time travel romance. It's not released until October this year, but I might have snaffled myself an early copy.
You're time traveling, reading the book about the time traveling romance.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
And speaking of snaffling early copies, next time we podcast, we'll be looking at The Two Lives of Lydia Bird by Josie Silver. I know I've been going on about this one for ages because, again, I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy from the publisher just before Christmas, I think. And it was released, the book has only just been released this month, so I'm hoping you'll enjoy it too. And if anyone else out there wants to read along before we come back to the next podcast, they can do that. I know that they won't be travelling anywhere except maybe through time because of the travel bans. But while we are waiting for those travel bans to lift, you can write to us at email s3pod@gmail.com with your reactions to the show, quarantine book recommendations, or to let us know if you've read the last day and what you thought of it. And you can subscribe to the S3 podcast through Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and most other places you get your podcasts from. You can also listen and find updates at www.s3pod.com when I get around to putting it online.
And you can also find my other podcast where I talk about the writing process, my free short stories that I put up every month, and find links to my book at terrytalksfiction.com.
And when you're done reading Terry's book, you can find my work at www.belindamisson.com or on Amazon if you search for my name.
So stay tuned, guys, for the next episode coming up sometime as soon. We're all navigating our way through the coming weeks and months. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we look forward to talking to you then.
And wash your damn hands.